In the past few years, we've been hearing more and more about the concept of food miles, measuring how far your food has come to get to your plate. But actually, provisions have been moving around the globe ever since humans began to travel. Sarah Murray writes about that history in Movable Feasts, From Ancient Rome to the 21st Century, The Incredible Journeys of the Food We Eat. It's published by St. Martin's Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Sarah Murray to the show today. Hello.
Hello, it's nice to be here.
You're a contributor to the Financial Times. Do you see this as a business story?
Well, actually, it's funny you should say that, because I'd been working as a business reporter for many years, and what first got me interested in all of this was that I started... I was actually out on the docks looking at some shipping containers, and I remember one of them was open, and I looked into the back of the shipping container and I saw some, you know, pineapples and things being unloaded, and I had a kind of eureka moment, and I thought, well, my goodness, this is how everything gets transported around. So I started looking deeper and then more historically at the containers we use.
Wasn't that shipping container in Vietnam?
That's right, yes, yes.
Is there relevance to that?
No, apart from the fact that I was working out there and looking for pictures of global trade, and I suppose that's what I turned to.
How big can those containers get, and how much can they hold?
Well, I mean, a single shipping container holds about 48,000 bananas, and some of these, I mean, some of the biggest ships now hold about 11,000 shipping containers, so it's, potentially huge amounts of food can be transported that way.
Most of them refrigerated?
A lot of them are, yes. A lot of them have these very sophisticated sort of temperature controls.
Obviously, the Romans didn't use shipping containers when they were exporting olive oil. How did they store it?
Well, they used what was called the amphora, which was just basically a large pot. It was about the size of a small barrel. It had a pointed base, and it was actually not designed to be stood up. It was designed so that it could sort of fit against the side of the ship. What was fascinating when I went on a dig in Rome to find some of these remains of these containers was that all the markings you see on them, a lot of them had the weight, the date that they were shipped, the name of the shipper, quite similar to what you see on the back of a modern shipping container.
They just didn't have nutritional information on it.
That's right.
Was olive oil easier to transport because it was processed and had a longer shelf life?
Yes, olive oil, you didn't have to worry about perishability. I mean, that was one thing the Romans didn't have. Even so, they did transport a lot of food, you know, some of it potted fruits from Syria and things like that. So, you know, they had quite a global supply of food.
And spices were a major trade export, weren't they?
That's right. I mean, they had spices have been found in Rome from China and India, so, you know, incredibly long trade routes there.
And not just the Romans. You also write about the sophisticated Incan system for moving food.
That's right, yes. They constructed a huge network of roads across the empire, and they had these series of runners that would sort of like relay runners. And, you know, I think the story goes that the emperor could actually get fish in the middle of the empire from the coast in a matter of days.
Well, the problem there was that they hadn't invented the wheel, even though they were one of the most sophisticated cultures. They also didn't invent written language, and yet made some of the best cotton that ever has been made.
Yes, that's right. They had a sort of uneven sort of sophistication to the civilization.
Well, when we look at remains from any part of the ancient world, we find things from very far away, which would suggest that trade developed as soon as civilization developed.
I mean, as soon as we've been able to move things around, we have. And I think that's one of the, particularly food has always been something that people want to get more of and to get more exotic versions of.
Although shipping was the best way because it could move it a lot faster than most other systems?
You mean shipping now or in the past?
Then, and I wonder whether it's still a favored approach.
Well, today it is purely because of the volumes, and certainly it's a very fuel-efficient way of transporting as well.
Well, because a ship can carry so much, what would be logically carried by a ship as opposed to transported by plane?
Not that much is transported by plane. Very highly perishable goods are transported by plane. But actually, as shipping containers become more sophisticated, even things like avocados, which in the past you'd had to have flown, can now go on a ship.
But aren't vegetables and fruits picked earlier when they're going to be shipped because they are expected to ripen along the way?
That's right. And actually, that's something that started fairly early on. I mean, in the 19th century, the whole of Central America was transformed by the invention of the refrigerated ship, because suddenly, instead of your bananas, melting into a pulp on the top of the deck, you could actually keep them cool. And there they would pick them unripe and then ship them. By the time they arrived, they'd be ripe.
People outside the tropics didn't even know what a banana was until refrigeration came along.
No, I mean, and the transformation was astonishing. And the end of the 19th century, there were magazines that were actually running instructions on how to peel a banana because it was such an unknown sort of fruit. Then the refrigerated ship came in, and literally a couple of decades later, it was being referred to as the poor man's fruit. It was so common.
But ripening that way, it's not the same as if it ripens right on the tree.
No, that's right. And I mean, that's you notice it most with tomatoes, where they will ripen them artificially with ethylene when they get to the supermarket, and really it reddens them, and but it doesn't really. That's why they have that sort of crunchiness, which is not as appealing.
And that's why a lot of shipping today is done by trucks. For example, in the winter, restaurants rely on producers in Florida who ship the tomatoes up. It takes about a day, but they can be picked pretty much ripe and then arrive at the restaurants in time to be served that night.
That's right. That's ideal. And the further it comes, the more artificially you have to ripen it, and it you lose a lot in the flavor.
On the other hand, that leaves that is kind of environmentally unfriendly, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because when I first started to look at this, and I thought, well, obviously transport is going to be the most damaging part of food's footprint. And actually, as it turns out, transport's only a very small proportion of that. When you start to look at agriculture and manufacturing chemical fertilizers, heating tomatoes in hothouses, I mean, I think the British did a study and found that actually shipping tomatoes from Spain, where they could be grown outside, was more environmentally friendly than growing them in hothouses in England.
Hmm. There are certain things that have to be flown, like strawberries, because
yes,
they're just going to go bad if you keep them even in the best refrigerated conditions for a couple of days.
That's right.
Lettuce, another one?
Yes, lettuce would be another one. And a lot of berries, very sensitive berries, would go that way.
Packing is an important part, isn't it? An important part of the preservation process. Oak barrels, for example, really changed the way a lot of things could be shipped.
Yes, and they were amazingly efficient. I mean, it was a very simple structure, but barrels can actually be rolled when full by one hand, a person just using one hand, because of the curve of the side of the barrel. They're very easy to move around.
Why did people even come up with the idea of using barrels?
I'm not sure how they first. I think it was the Celts in the third century that first came up with them. They were a very, very early form of transport, but they just proved incredibly robust. The way they're constructed is based on architectural principles. So it's like a sort of barrel vault.
But you also suggest here that people saw that wood would could keep the water from coming inside a ship. And so they assume that if you ship something, some liquid in a barrel, that the same sort of thing would happen the other way.
It's the sort of reverse of a ship, actually. You're keeping the water in rather than pushing it out. And of course, at some point along the way, they discovered that it actually started to change the taste of what was inside.
Such as wine, which is shipped in oak barrels, winds up in taking up some of the taste of the oak.
That's right. And actually, the Madeira, which was a Portuguese wine, which came from the island of Madeira, for a long while, they actually thought that it was the process of shipping it that resulted in its flavor. And so, in fact, in the 19th century, they used to put it in barrels and ship it off through the tropics and back, believing that that was what created the taste.
Well, other kinds of wine are affected negatively by too much movement. So that is a problem even today when the French and the Italians try to export really good wines to the United States. They have to worry about whether it's going to get jostled about.
That's right. And I mean, I think Madeira, you know, was looked down upon as a wine for a long time because of this fact that it had been sort of shipped to and fro.
What about other kinds of foods like cheeses? How are they shipped so that their freshness can be maintained?
Well, I think they you would use the same sort of refrigerated containers. The temperatures will just vary between, ice cream, which has a certain requirement, and cheese, which might be a lesser temperature.
Well, we're still talking about things that are grown one place or made in one place and then sent somewhere else. But today, often things go to two or three different places before they wind up on our table. Salmon, for example, harvested in Northern Europe and then sent to China. Why?
Well, that's all really to do with when your transport costs come down, you really look much more closely at the processing costs, and a lot of salmon has to be filleted by hand, and so it's cheaper to do it in China. So they go on this astonishing round trip.
Well, this is nothing completely new, because I remember many years ago being in Denver and ordering the mountain trout, and they said, "Why do you want to order that?" And I said, "Well, it's local." And they said, "Oh, no, it's caught here. They ship it to Seattle where it's frozen and processed, and then it comes back here." And I thought, gee, that's a pretty stupid way to go about things.
I guess it's what people wanted. I mean, the other amazing example I came across was the fact that tea is now, English-style tea is becoming very popular in China in a lot of the affluent cities. And Tea comes from China. So there's one particular brand of tea. They ship it all the way back to North Yorkshire in England. They blend it and package it in a nice little English packet, and then it goes straight back to Shanghai.
My guest is Sarah Murray, who's written a book called Movable Feast, From Ancient Rome to the 21st Century, The Incredible Journeys of the Food We Eat, published by St. Martin's Press. Isn't there a loss of quality when something like that salmon is frozen, thawed, and then refrozen?
There is a certain amount, not as much as you would think. There's a certain amount of moisture that obviously gets in, and then it does lose its quality. But fish generally, I mean, we like to talk about having fresh fish, but because fish deteriorates almost immediately, we're almost never really eating fresh fish. You wouldn't want to, because it would, you know, if it's been around for a few hours, it really would start deteriorating.
And then people buy the fish at the fish store and stick it in their freezer anyway, and then thaw it later. But that isn't always possible. Was the military where tin cans were developed?
So many developments have come out of the military and still do. But yes, Napoleon actually offered a prize to somebody who could come up with a way of preserving food for the troops so that they could actually eat on the move. And a guy called Nicolas Appert in France had been bottling things and sealing them, and found that lasted. And actually it was with the military that took off.
And until this day.
Yeah, absolutely.
But aren't new technologies being developed by the military to eliminate the tin can?
All the time. I mean, in the 70s, there was what's called the retort package was developed, which is a sort of flexible form. I mean, the actual processing isn't so different. You know, you heat food to a high temperature and then seal it immediately. But, of course, the packaging...
Vacuum seal it.
You vacuum seal it, yes. And the packaging is now much more flexible, and it can be sort of thrown out of helicopters, and soldiers can run around with it.
How did the Berlin airlift change the way we think about moving food?
That was an extraordinary story. I mean, that was really almost a battle won by moving food. It was the first Cold War victory. Stalin had surrounded Berlin, and the Allies were determined to keep West Berlin in the West's hands. The only way that they could possibly get food in were three air corridors, which had been remained, they had to remain open. And they literally, you know, there were planes arriving and landing every 3 seconds. I mean, we think it's crowded at LaGuardia, but it's nothing compared to that.
Well, people who rely on rations often complain about the lack of variety. Is it important? Do certain foods just lend themselves better to that kind of packaging than others?
Well, in the Berlin Airlift, they were restricted by certain things. Obviously, weight was a huge thing, and so they threw out a lot of ideas of sort of more interesting foods because they would just take up too much space and weight, and their aim was literally just to feed people. And they kept people fed for a year by plane.
Michael Pollan, Alice Waters, and others have written about the impact of food transportation. How does your book differ from what they're saying?
Well, I think, talking about high-quality food, local food is usually, taste-wise, is phenomenal. But there's been a lot of talk about food miles and how, this is really the root of the carbon emissions created by food. And I'm really arguing that we should take a much more holistic picture of this. And when you start looking at it like that, transport is actually a very small part of the picture. I mean, I think really what you should look at is how sustainably things are being farmed, in which case you might ship it from further away if the methods are more sustainable.
You cite a study where it would take less energy to bring rice grown in Bangladesh to California than to try to irrigate and grow rice in California.
That's right, and there's a study from New Zealand as well, which shows that because New Zealand lamb can be grazed outside all year round, which means you don't need to feed them on cattle feeds, which are manufactured, and various other factors. Even if you include the shipping, New Zealand lamb is more sustainable when it gets to London than British lamb is.
Well, this is a matter of trade-offs, but some people might argue that Californians shouldn't eat rice if they have that kind of trade-off.
I think it's a tricky one. We've all got used to being able to eat anything we want, and trying to persuade people to go back to eating less is probably going to be a tough one.
And there are those slow food people who feel that eating locally is something that's natural, a continuation of the way that food has been consumed over centuries.
That might be true, but the Romans were, as I say, eating a very global diet. I don't think, long-distance food is not that new, actually.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think everybody agrees that we should be eating oranges, and they are not grown locally, no matter what. What are dabawalas? What do they do?
The dabawalas are the amazing system of lunch delivery in Bombay, or Mumbai, as it's now called. It grew up in the 19th century and has been going ever since. Basically, a man will come to your house at midday, pick up lunch, and deliver it to your husband's office through an amazing series of sort of relay handovers, changing trains, all sorts of things. And what's even more astonishing is that the same tin gets picked up once the food's been eaten and returned right back to the family.
And they can do that efficiently?
It's astonishing. I mean, I actually followed them around for a day, and they've got all they've got on the top of these tins are little scrawls and marks and numbers that I couldn't make anything out of.
So no computers or databases?
No computers, no databases, nothing. And in fact, they're so efficient that a lot of business schools and academics are now going over there to study how they do this.
Well, why is it necessary in Mumbai? And is this something that's unique to the city?
It does happen in a few places, but Mumbai is mainly the place where it happens, mainly because there's a huge diversity of cultures, and Indians are very concerned. If you're a vegetarian, for example, you won't eat food that's been anywhere near meat, and so you want to be very particular that your wife, who it is, your wife or your kids, have actually cooked the food for you. The second thing is that where people work is very far away from where they live, and so there's that, and a lot of Indians like to go home for dinner, and of course in Bombay you can't. And of course the third thing is that if you've ever been on a commuter train at 9 o'clock in Bombay, you can see why you don't want to get on there with tins of curry. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are people hanging out of the windows to stay on, and so you could probably about manage your briefcase, but that would be it.
You mentioned that moving food is something that goes back a long time. It's actually led to many changes in the world. Marco Polo would not have gone to China. Christopher Columbus probably wouldn't have been searching for a new trade route for the spice trade. Mm. So this is really something that... And then the Basque are supposed to have fished in the St. Lawrence Seaway when they were chasing the cod. So we've been traveling long distances to get our food for a long time.
Oh, yes. And the knock-on effects are always sometimes unexpected. I mean, one of the most fun things I came across was the grain elevators of buffalo, which were huge transshipment machines, made buffalo very rich in the 19th century and made it an enormous grain hub. And eventually that was overtaken by the St. Lawrence Seaway. But as soon as that was overtaken, the Bauhaus architects got very interested in the forms and shapes, and modern architecture really has a lot to do with that.
Sarah Murray is a travel writer with and has written for the Financial Times for years. Her book, Movable Feasts, is published by St. Martin's Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been great talking to you.
On tomorrow's show, Ruth Reichel joins me for our holiday cookie recipe swap. And thanks to all of you who've sent in your fabulous recipes. Also, Pulitzer Prize-winning oral historian Studs Terkel will tell his own life story. We'll talk about a new book about the science and aesthetics of the evolution process. And I'll also talk to a former software executive who moved to Paris to learn to cook at Le Cordon Bleu. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Scott Goldberg, and Sarah English. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Stephanie Hughes, Paula Crossfield, Rachel Kranz, and Fran Jacobs. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.